explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Arc of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Earth Explorers, it's good to be back after 2 weeks being off for the holidays, and we really appreciate you being here tonight with us on X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where it's beautiful, crisp, clear, cold night. Over 400 prominent scientists from more than two dozen countries recently voiced significant objections to major aspects of the so-called consensus on man-made global warming. These scientists, many of whom are current and former participants in the UN IPCC, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, criticized the climate claims made by the UN IPCC and former Vice President Al Gore. This blockbuster Senate report lists the scientists by name, country of residence, and academic institutional affiliation. It also features their own words, biographies, and web links to their peer-reviewed studies and original source materials as gathered from public statements, various news outlets, and websites in 2007. The new Consensus Busters report is poised to redefine the debate. It's about time. We need a little bit of open debate on the subject of global warming. TikTok. Tick-tock, it's been 71 days since Comet 17P Holmes exploded on October 24, 2007, brightening almost a millionfold to naked eye visibility. This means it could be time for another explosion. To understand why 71 days is significant, we turn back the clock to the year 1892. Comet Holmes was discovered on November 6, 1892 by astronomer Edwin Holmes while he was making observations of the Andromeda Galaxy. He noticed the comet not far from Andromeda when it exploded, a brightening akin to that of October 2007. It was quite a sensation as observers around the world suddenly were able to see the comet with the naked eye. Interest faded as the comet expanded and dimmed. But then, 71 days later, on January 16, 1893, Holmes exploded again. Deja vu? Well, we shall see. Today, the solar wind is a powerful 617.8 kilometers per second. That's way up from what it was 2 weeks ago. Solar physicists have been waiting for the appearance of a reversed polarity sunspot to signal the start of the next solar cycle. Well, the wait is over. Yesterday, a magnetically reversed sunspot emerged at solar latitude 30 degrees north. Sunspot 981 is a high-latitude reverse polarity sunspot, and a solar wind stream hit Earth on January 5th, sparking the first auroras of solar cycle number 24. For those of you that don't really know the significance of that or haven't thought about it, once these solar flares become highly energetic, as they do when they get in the high latitudes of the sun, it emits a lot of cosmic rays, and cosmic rays are directly related to cloud cover. Increased cloud cover means a cooler Earth. Sounds like we're going through a cycle, doesn't it? Despite funding uncertainty, NASA is on track to return humans to the moon by 2020 and set up a lunar outpost to serve as a springboard to explore Mars, officials said Monday. Our job is to build towns on the moon and eventually put tire prints on Mars, NASA's Rick Gelbrick told reporters here. 1 year after the U.S. Space Agency unveiled an ambitious plan to site a solar-powered manned outpost on the South Pole of the Moon. We have the International Space Station, we're going to have a lunar outpost, and someday, certainly, somebody will go to Mars, said Jeff Hanley, head of NASA's Constellation Program, which is developing the tools to return humans to the Moon. Gee, it's been a long time since 1972 flight of Apollo 17 with Cernan Evans and Schmidt on board. They were the last manned mission to the moon for the United States. By the way, that was a long time before internet and before high-speed computers, so we ought to be able to do it better this time. Last week, we had the former senior physicist and department head for the Michelson Interferometer Spectrometer and the current director of research for the Meru Foundation, Stanley Tienen. You want to go back and listen to that one when you get a chance. And after that, we had Ronald Mallett. Last 2 weeks, we hope you enjoyed listening to Joe LaStella and William Henry. They are very exciting guests. This week, we have one of the most exciting authors and medical professionals in the world, a cell biologist by training. He taught cell biology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, and later performed pioneering studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. His book, The Biology of Belief, was a national bestseller and enlightened the medical community of the West to ideas well known in the East for millennia. He is now on X Squared Radio. Please welcome with me Bruce Lipkin. How are you, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely wonderful, and so glad to be here tonight.
This is going to be great. I was sent the book by your publisher, and I got to say, this is really, really a well-written, well-done book. From the cover all the way through, I've got notes all the way through it, and it should be a really interesting evening. I guess the way to start, for centuries, at least from my research, it was known that the beliefs and environment of a person determined his level of physical health and development. Then, the study of biology grew to illustrative anatomy, and then with the use of the first microscopes, bacteria and microbes were revealed as the smallest forms of life, and then with the advent of the scanning electron microscope, the molecular nature of biology was discovered. Now, with Dr. Lipkin's research, we have arrived at the most advanced understanding of biology in the universe, that belief and environment are the main controlling factors for physical health and development. Wow, one eternal round, isn't it?
Well, it's an exciting time, Brooks, because it's we're facing crises and necessity is the mother of invention, and it's just interesting that by necessity we have a new science, which is going to help us really thrive into the future.
I like it. Well, I'm sure that there are many people out there who had that first eyepiece experience, but what made it turn you on to this lifelong journey in biology?
Well, for me, when I was a kid in school, and the first time I saw through a microscope and they showed us some amoebas and paramecium, and here I am, this little kid, looking into this microscope, and the first thing I saw was that these little cells weren't just like pinballs bouncing all over the place. They were actually like looking over here and then moving over there and looking for a while and then moving. So in my kid mind, it was like these were like little sentient beings. And the fun part was, about 20 years later, when I end up in graduate school cloning cells, I find this to be absolutely true, that every cell is the equivalent of a miniature human. And when I used to teach in medical school, in opening days of cell biology and histology, I bring up this very important parallel that people didn't understand, and that is this, we look in the mirror and see ourselves as single individuals. That itself is a very big misperception, because in truth, we're actually communities of cells. Each human is made up of about 50 trillion cells, and the cells are the living entities. Every cell is a sentient little entity that responds and lives in a world. What's interesting is then we, when we say that word we, actually represent communities of cells. And so why that becomes important is that then we understand the nature of health and disease in our bodies in regard to how communities are doing, whether communities are in harmony or disharmony, and that's directly connected to health and disease. But getting back to the point about the members of this community, these cells, here's the other fact that I told medical students, and that is there's not one new function in our entire human body that's not already been present in a single cell. That single cells have all the functions that we have: digestive systems, respiratory, excretory, nervous system, reproductive system. Every cell even has an immune system. So in a real literal truth, a human and a cell are almost like replicas of each other, but the cell just doesn't have the capacities that the human has for any of the functions. So the nervous system of the cell is relatively simple, but it's enough to enable them to live in harmony in a community and create a human body. So it's relatively complex, and yet our brain, having a trillion or so cells, is a trillion times more powerful than a conventional cell in that regard. So what really becomes very interesting is this, is that when we start talking about cells, we're actually talking about miniature-like people that are living in a community. And when we understand how they work and how they can make a community that can be in harmony, I mean, think about it for a second, that under our skin are 50 trillion citizens, that when we're in a healthy, happy state, that means 50 trillion citizens in this nation are all in that same health and harmony. So, you know, here we are on the whole planet trying to get 6.5 billion people to survive, okay, and underneath our skin are 50 trillion cells that have learned the secrets of living in harmony. So the interesting fact is that this world is a gold mine of information, because it offers a lot of information about ourselves as individuals and our relationships in the world of creating a biological living organism, where we are actually cells in a larger organism called humanity. So it's a multicellular organism, humanity, and each one of us is a cell in that structure. So if you want to see how humanity could thrive, then you really look inside the body and say, well, how are those 50 trillion cells managing in their world? And every cell, as I said, like a miniature person, every cell has a job. Every cell gets paid. Every cell has health care. They have this garbage taken out in their world. In other words, they live in communities just like we do. So they are really very important populations to study, to understand the nature of us as individuals and the nature of us as an organism called humanity.
Well, maybe we need to find a biologist to run for president, because that sure sounds like the solution to me. If we can make a trillion cells live in harmony, surely it should be no problem to get 6 billion people to live in harmony.
Well, absolutely, because they have to deal with the same constraints that we have in our own world about resources and materials and maintaining an environment and all the other things that we deal with. They even get paid, so they have a currency called ATP, which is like the actually in biology books they call it the coin of the realm. And why that's relevant, then, if you actually study the flow and usage and storage of ATP, it's actually what we should be doing with our resources, our money, in the same way, because they've managed this perfect, wonderful balance.
Well, I notice some people have succumbed to the biology of urban spread, too, so we're or urban sprawl.
Well, that brings up this topic that I hope we get into during the evening, Brooks, and that is that I said, well, you know, we are communities, and I said, well, that we, what does that really represent? And in truth, what it really represents is that your thought of your personal identity is actually a community of those 50 trillion cells. So our mind is essentially a government. Sort of like a dictator. It could be a benevolent dictator. It could be, in some cases, as you mentioned, not such a great dictator. But basically, the mind is controlling the fate of the cells, and that's its function. It is the awareness by which 50 trillion citizens inside are using to read their world to adjust their biology to survive. So our mind is the interface between what's going on in the world and our biology on the inside. And then the issues are if our minds have been misprogrammed, as we'll talk about, then the programming or misprogramming could lead to disharmony. And so it turns out that most all the illnesses we have on this planet are not due to physical genetic defects. They're actually due to the way that we're driving these biology bodies, these vehicles that we have.
Sure.
And we didn't get good driver education.
Well, how did your viewpoint of this change the first time you got to use an electron microscope?
Well, as a kid, I was looking from the outside of the cells and looking at them as a person would see people from an airplane. I was watching them down below. But when I got into the electron microscope in graduate school and then in my university job, it took it to another level because now I wasn't looking at the cells. I was inside of them and flying through them. I mean, it was the most wonderful job I could imagine having. Every day I'd go to work and I'd look at some biological tissues and cells and see things that no one had ever seen before because this was like this frontier. It wasn't the frontier out there. It was the frontier in here, more or less. And it was a new frontier. So it was real exciting to see how a cell operated from the interior and the nature of its functions, to recognize the very important parallels that the human body is really built on the pattern or plan of the cell. So why that got exciting in that period in the electron microscope is all of a sudden to realize that if you really understood the nature of the biology inside the cell, you also then understood the foundational nature of human biology. Because it's built upon that pattern, and hopefully again later we'll talk about the concept of fractals, because this is the insight that offers how you can see and decipher those patterns between cells and people.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. We're comparing a cell to a human body or to a human being, and there are different parts to the cell. I mean, there's the vacuoles and mitochondria, and there's the nucleus. And I think for a long time, the biological community thought that the nucleus was the brain of the cell. But, you know, there was, because it had all the genetic code inside of it. But
based on the belief that genes control life, that would make sense.
Right, right. Well, when was it discovered that the nucleus was not the brain of the cell?
Well, actually, over 100 years ago, and this was on some of the very earliest embryology experiments, these experimental scientists back in those days, 1920 or so, were working with organisms. They're actually working with, like, marine organisms such as starfish and sea urchins because their eggs were very large, and you could manipulate them under the microscope. And back then, they saw the nucleus in the cell, but they weren't very clear at that time of its full function or how it worked, but it was obviously connected to heredity. So what they ended up doing at some point was using very small pipettes that they would suck the nucleus out of the cell. Well, the nucleus comes out, all the genes come out. But what was the surprising thing about this, in a number of cases, for example, if they did this with, a starfish egg and then sucked the nucleus out, that egg would then divide into maybe up to 60 cells and form an embryo, none of the cells having genes in it. And then other experiments started to reveal that you could take the nucleus out of a cell, and the cells would last for two or more months with no genes in it. And they're not just like sitting there lifeless, they're doing everything a normal cell does. They eat, breathe, they defecate, they move around, they read the environment and avoid toxins. They're doing everything without genes in it. And so at some point you have to stop and say, well, my goodness, there's a lot of control here. The thing's alive and has a very purposeful existence, and it doesn't even have genes. So at some point, the concepts of genes controlling life, that just didn't make sense anymore. But we got involved in the science of genetics and the business of genetics, and that little insight disappeared when we started to buy into what is called the central dogma, which is actually a hypothesis that was made by Francis Crick, and he's the guy that Watson and Crick were the co-founders of the DNA structure. Well, Francis Crick, so enamored with the idea of DNA and heredity, created what is actually written in the book. It's called The Central Dogma of Biology. And that's the belief that information flows in biology in one direction that goes from DNA to RNA and then into protein. And the relevance about that for us is we are the protein. The human body is this protein machine, but it's programmed by information apparently from the DNA. That was the central dogma of Francis Crick. So when you believe that flow of information, then everything starts with DNA. Then by that definition, DNA controls life. That's the belief system. Yet those experiments from the early 20s, they were just disregarded. In fact, they were already 30 or 40 years in history and nobody paid attention to them. But the genetic idea took hold, and especially after Watson and Crick's discovery, and then all of science focused everything on genes. So at some point, every defect, every issue of health, every attribute or deficit in our lives was some way attributed to our DNA. So all of a sudden, we started looking at our heredity as essentially a blueprint of our lives. That's the way it's actually mentioned in the books. So that if you buy into that belief, then not only do genes control your life, but your fate is essentially determined at the moment of conception when the genes that go to make up your body are selected. So at some point, we become the victims of our heredity because DNA controls life, and that's what most people were taught. And most people, unfortunately, still believe that genes are responsible for controlling all of our traits, except conventional scientists and research scientists know full well that this is not true at all. Genes control nothing. And yet the public is in the belief that genes control things. So every few days in the papers or on the news, you read a story or hear a story about a gene that controls this behavior or a gene that causes something like that. And it's like, these are absolutely untrue statements. And they might want to say, that's a shorthand for the public, but it's misleading.
Well, if it's evident, and I mean scientifically, clinically, repeatably evident that a cell can function and react to its environment and eat and everything without the nucleus, what was providing the cell its instructions?
Well, that was the fun part of the search. That was get out the old Sherlock Holmes magnifying glass and say, where the heck in the cell is something that's controlling it, the equivalent of the brain? And so what I really started to do was to go back into earlier forms of life until I got to the bacterium, which is the most primitive form of life on the planet. And here's a structure, when you look at it in the microscope, has a membrane around the outside and soup on the inside. There's no real things like nuclei or mitochondria or vesicles. It's just like soup and a membrane. And then you say, wow, that's about as primitive a cell as you can get. And then you say, well, what functions does this have? And it says, well, it has a digestive system and a respiratory and an excretory and a nervous system. They respond to the environment. It's like, yeah, but where in the cell could this be? And when you look at the cell, the only structure that actually has any structure to it is the membrane. So I really said, well, somehow in this mechanism, there's got to be the control. And up at that point when I started looking at the membrane, conventional biology would define the membrane like something like plastic wrap with holes in it that would allow stuff in and out of the cells. So the function of the membrane was like a skin that allows stuff to go from one side to the other side. But it turns out they were misled because it actually has such a simple structure, and the reality is, in its simplicity, is the elegance of control. The membrane, this is what I found out in 1985, and it transformed my entire life. After 10 years of trying to look at how does this membrane act as a brain, per se, 1985 was like 1:59 in the morning, and I'm putting together a review, just reviewing my work for 10 years of how does this work. And I sat there and wrote a definition down in a different way than I had done before. And I wrote this definition down. This was 1985. And I wrote, the cell membrane is a liquid crystal semiconductor with gates and channels. And for me, in 1985, I wrote that down and I said, wow, I've just read a definition of the same definition. I couldn't even think of, I was so excited, I couldn't think, where did I read that definition? And there in front of me was my first Macintosh, and next to it was a book from Radio Shack called Understanding Your Microprocessor, simpleton book for my first computer.
Microprocessors for dummies.
Yeah, essentially. So that's what it was back in 1985. And so I opened the book up quickly and saw, and I read in the introduction the definition of a computer chip, which was a crystal semiconductor with gates and channels. And then the first second I said, oh, what a coincidence. The cell membrane and the computer chip have the same definition, you know? And then all of a sudden, it's just like my brain got fired up, and I said, wait a minute. It took all this data and said, this is not a coincidence, definition by definition, structure by structure. It is a computer chip. And it was not, so it's not, the analogy is when something is like the body is like a vehicle, that's an analogy, because the body is not a vehicle. But there's a word, homology. Homology means the same as. So when I say the cell membrane is homologous to a computer chip, that statement specifically says the cell membrane is a computer chip. By definition, by structure, by the proteins built into this membrane, this is an organic computer chip. And the idea is it reads the environment using a keyboard built on the surface of the cell that responds to the signals of the environment. And then the data goes through the membrane and then adjusts the functions of the cells on the inside. So all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, the brain of the cell is this membrane which functions in the exact same way a computer chip does. It has bits of data, inputs and outputs, IOs, that take information from the outside environment and then use that to drive a function on the inside. And then it turns out, I looked at it and I said, oh my God, the nucleus is a disk with programs in it. And what happens is the cell responds to the environment and then calls up programs out of the nucleus, out of the hard drive. And why that becomes relevant is because conventional science made the hard drive the brain, but the hard drive, it's just data. It can't use it unless you have a computer. The computer
That's right.
is the cell.
Yeah, without the CPU, it's just a memory device.
Exactly, and same thing with viruses. This is a joke that some people say, well, life was seeded on this planet when viruses got here. And what people don't realize when they say that is that a virus is a piece of information, nucleic acid, wrapped in a membrane. It's not living, it has no cell. It's the equivalent of like a memory stick for a computer. It's got data. And why is it relevant? Well, the idea is you can seed the entire planet with all the viruses you want, but if you don't have a computer to read the virus, then you can't create anything from it. So life wasn't created from viruses. Viruses were created from cells, and cells make viruses as communications from one to another. So why all this becomes relevant is we must get away from the belief that genes are aware in things that they're intelligent things, like Richard Dawkins' belief in the selfish gene, is that the genes are the real things of life. That Dawkins' belief is genes built us as vehicles to carry them around. So that's the basic reductionism of all time. But the reality is, no, genes are data. They're programs. That's exactly what they are. They're encoded on DNA strings of programs, and the programs are read by the computer, which is the membrane. And the membrane calls up.
Yeah. Here's a question I often get. If every cell of our body has the same genetic material, the same DNA, then how does a cell know to form into eye tissue or a bone or a kidney?
That wonderful question, because the answer to that is it reads the local environment. And so it's sort of like a plane knows where it is by a device called triangulation. They read two different points and then calculate where they are between the two points. Cells move through their world and are reading signals from different points, and depending on where they are in relation to those points, that selects a program that out of the database, where they can become anything. The program is selected because they're in a certain place in the physical position where this information selects those switches to become bone or muscle or kidney or whatever it's supposed to be. So
that raises two more questions, though. One is, what about the first time around? I mean, we're going from basically two cells, one very small, a sperm cell, one very large, the female egg, and we're going to build an organism. There is no local community. And the second one is, what do you do about the interface, like where the ligament connects to the bone or where the eye tissue connects to a muscle? How does the interface cell know what to be?
Okay, the first question, where does the first pattern come from? Okay, so this is exciting, right? Because this is a new vision that's coming in and replaces old ideas of pre-imprinted genetic programs, that there are fields of energy, electrical fields, like magnetic fields, electromagnetic fields, actually, that surround an embryo. And I remember back in the 60s, a person I knew from Princeton had done some research and was reading these fields over the surface of an embryo. And the beautiful part about it, by reading the graph paper, the shape of the field was the shape of the forming embryo. So it started to get information that there's patterns first, and the cells read the pattern, and reading the pattern selects the genes that then create all the sub-patterns inside a field. So a ligament knows where to go to connect, or actually nerves are interesting, know where to go, because on the surface of nerves, remember I said there were like keyboards which read information, and that these surface receptors, they're like little antennas, protein antennas, that these receptors are reading signals in the environment and following them to their source. So that if I match a nerve cell to a muscle and let it match so that the nerve cell is tuned to the muscle cell frequency, then at some point that nerve cell will guide itself following the frequency to get to the muscle. So there's this new involvement of invisible fields, which conventional biology has been very reluctant to go into. And it's an unfortunate situation because they're reluctant to...
You're describing there is kind of a spirit blueprint that the biology then assumes.
I'm glad you
in 3D.
Said that. I'm glad you said that, because I would say that, but since you offer that up first, the fact is, here's what's neat. Quantum physicists since 1925 have established, let me give you like this most important quote from Albert Einstein. It's so important. It goes like this. Here's a quote. Albert Einstein wrote, "The field is the sole governing agency of the particle." What he meant by that, in the simplest of terms, is the field, which is represented the invisible energy forces, the electromagnetic fields and currents in the environment, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle. What he meant is matter. So what he said is the field is the sole governing agency of matter, and that is a fundamental understanding and quantum physics in the world that we live in. And why that's important, it says that the field exists, that it's energy, and it's the most fundamental factor in shaping the physical character of matter. And so here we have physicists talking about these invisible, moving, shaping forces. And then you start to realize, well, geez, you know, it's not really very different than spiritual people have been talking about these invisible, moving, shaping forces. You start to realize, they're pretty much talking about the same thing all of a sudden, aren't they? So it's a real interesting coming of age of science, and science separated itself from spirit in its original inception. Science said it would only study the physical world and left the invisible world to the church. And at some point, science, through the findings of quantum physics, has to own the reality that even what we call the physical world isn't really physical because it's all energy fields in itself. So science is coming back to an understanding of the invisible forces of spirit.
Well, hopefully we're doing it in an intelligent manner instead of a superstitious manner.
Oh, absolutely. That makes all the difference in the world. You know,
yeah.
It makes all the difference in the world, because if you do it with a scientific understanding, then you really have a much greater realistic insight into the unfolding rather than to, as you said, get into the stories and myths and things like that. Now you can actually, it's a part of science.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking this whole program about the realization, the absolutely irrefutable proof that environment is what is probably the primary influence as to what a person looks like, or what their health is, or what the shape of their body is. But we know that genetic code can determine our eye color or the shape of our teeth or the length of our bones. But when we consider that the environment and the individual's response to that environment determines the look of that being, then you really have to reconsider whether it's the genetic code or the biology's response to the environment. And that includes this energy field that he's talking about. As to what makes the human being, the organism that you call Bruce and I call Brooks and all the Earth explorers out there call themselves, what really makes you up? And there's a considerable community that believes, and not just modern, but also very ancient, that believes that that we reincarnate, that this spirit that makes ourselves up comes back over and over again as additional human bodies to get more and more information from more and more mortal experience. And that means that the energy pattern that we bring forward makes us or shapes us the way we've always looked. Now that opens a lot of really neat considerations. So let's go back to the slide of the swimming one-celled animals under the microscope. Each cell had to do everything for itself, right? I mean, it had to eat. It had to
In the beginning, they were single living organisms. They lived alone, and they communicated over distances with things like viruses. But they essentially were in a community, but what you would call a dispersed community, and they were like free living cells in a larger dispersed community where every cell carried out every function. But at some point, about 700 million years ago, there were just single cells up to that point, about 3.5 billion years almost of life on this planet as just single cells like bacteria and algae and amoebas and paramecium and yeast, just single cell organisms. And then about 700 million years ago, a radical change occurred, and the change actually led to the assembly of cells into communities. The very first communities were just colonial, meaning a group of cells would all hang together in like a jello-like mass, and that kept them in close proximity to each other, and they could send information back and forth kind of easily, so there was a lot of information being exchanged. But every cell was still pretty much doing all the individual jobs that any cell needed to stay alive. But at some point, the numbers in these communities started to get very large. And it would be very silly if everybody in the community as a cell did exactly the same thing. So in the larger communities, the cells actually took on specialized functions. They were essentially like, in human populations, you'd almost call them guild cells, where somewhere in history there were the guild that made wine and the guild that made barrels and the guild that did this. Well, the cells made guilds, where some were like muscle cells and some were nerve cells and some were stomach cells, and they all had these different functions, but they were, every cell still was like a person. It had to eat and had to breathe and get rid of waste and all that. Whether it was a muscle cell or a nerve cell, it was still like a person with a job. And so what was interesting is then the community subdivided the workload. And we call that process in biology differentiation, where you start out as multi-potential cells, and then as the embryo develops, then they start to express very specific traits and characters, such as bone or muscle. So differentiated communities of cells were cells that were in such large numbers that it was more efficient to take on specialized jobs and work in a community of exchange than it was for everybody to do the same thing. And that led to organisms with trillions of cells, such as ourselves. And so here we are in this community. Now, the interesting part about this community is that just like every cell has to read the environment and just its biology, again, using the parallel between a human and a cell, I would say consider when you walk outside the door, if it's hot out, your skin picks up the temperature that it's hot out and changes your physiology so you begin to perspire and cool off. So the temperature outside is really directly causing your body to change its function. But if you walk out when it's cold out, you get a completely different neural response. And this time the nervous system actually goes and cranks up the heater and makes things hotter to keep balance. And again, the behavior wasn't an intellectual conscious control. It was a direct response to the environment. So the cells are in their world responding to the environment like we respond to our environment. But now, let's say you have a community of 50 trillion cells, like a human body, and then you have to say, well, yeah, but the liver cells can't see what's going on in the environment, the kidney can't see what's going on in the environment, so what should they do? And here's the point, that a number of these cells differentiated or specialized as nerve cells. And the function of the nerve cells, read the environment and then relay the information back into the body to adjust the biology to stay alive in whatever was going on in the environment. Well, then a bunch of these specialized cells form in evolution a structure called the brain, which is like the central processing place where all the information is coming in and being analyzed and then being sent back out through the body. And so the brain's function, and here it is to read the environmental signals and then adjust the biology of the cells to stay alive in that environment, which is, go back to the cell, which I said, what was the function of the membrane? To read the environmental signals and then adjust the biology inside the cell to stay alive. Well, the cell in human, again, parallel, it's all the same. So here's what's interesting, though, in a human, that the brain is an interface between the environment and the cells, and the brain makes interpretations. Well, the issue about the worlds that we live in and the complexity is the interpretations are created in something, an experience that we call the mind. So the mind is paying attention to what's going on in the environment, interpreting what it sees, and then sending information into the biology to adjust the physiology of the body, including all kinds of characters like turning the immune system on and off, et cetera, and stuff like that. So all of a sudden it says, then the mind is an interpretation of the environment. And here's where the problem comes from, is that in our learning experiences, many of them are fraught with misinterpretations. And if we misinterpret the environment, that means when a signal comes in and we misinterpret that environment, we could disturb or destroy the biology, cause disease. I'll give you an example. Let's say if we were talking and there was an anorexic person in front of us and we'd look at this person and they're just like skin and bones near death and we're just horrified, my God, these persons are barely alive, and we say to this person, well, when you look in the mirror, what do you see? And the answer is, they see an overweight person. Their mirror is like a funhouse mirror from an amusement park. But here's the problem. The brain perceives an overweight person and then adjusts the biology in accordance with that image to reduce further the weight of that individual. And the problem is this. A distortion in the perception leads to their death. It wasn't anything physically wrong with them. Their body was reading the environment incorrectly, and it led to their own death. And so it says, then the mind, as the interface, has the problem with the human mind because of the way it learns, is that we can learn and we can mislearn. And if we mislearn how to respond to the world, then in that mislearning, when we have signals that come to our environment and we send the wrong signals into the body to respond to those signals because of a misperception, then the body is out of sync with the planet, the community, the individual, and life, and can cause great harm, if not death. So the mind then becomes the relevant factor controlling the genetics of the biology that we have. And if you change your mind, then you change your biology. And this is kind of stuff that was known for years, and unfortunately, it also gets confused with positive thinking, and I really want to get into that later to clear up an issue, because that has created more problems than anything, the concept of positive thinking, because we didn't understand the nature of mind.
Let's talk a little bit about the concept of mind, because I think there's a misnomer that the mind exists only in the brain. You know, we were talking about picking up stimulus from our environment, and you were talking about the sense of feel or temperature and taste and eyesight and hearing and all of that. But the cell membranes are fully capable of picking up stimulus from the environment on all kinds of energetic levels.
Absolutely.
And at a much faster rate than our brain. So isn't it possible that the mind itself is spread out over the whole body, and that it's possible to think with our heart or with our gut, so to speak, and thus adjust the biology of the body based on stimulus from the environment that our cells pick up, that our brain never
sees? This is absolutely the way it is, Brooke. It's that every cell has its own mind. And that's a group mind. So you're looking at group mind, but there is a central processor that will relay. You know what the central processor is like? It's like CNN. That is like the camera on the world with a guy with a microphone. As you look out at the world, there's a guy with a microphone reporting what's going on to 50 trillion cells. I said the liver cell can't see what's going on in the world. So to really know what's going on in the world, it's not only its local information, but there's information coming from the top down. And this information from the top down, as I said, if the information is in harmony with the biology, then this information provides for growth and health. And yet, if this disharmony exists between what's going on in the world and the interpretation of the mind, that inevitably leads to a breakdown of the biology. And then, because of our conventional medical system, any breakdown is like, well, that had nothing to do with you. That had to do with your genes. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, because they don't have the mind as an element that has been naturally built into biology. In fact, look, Descartes created the concept of a mind and a body duality. And then Newtonian physics said, yeah, there might be a mind and a body, but the world is a physical world, and all that matters is physical stuff, and the mind might be an epiphenomenon, something that comes from the operation of the physical body, but in no way does it go back in and influence it. From that time, medicine has left the mind out of the equation because it focuses only on the physical body. And the interesting thing is, to do that, it had to close its eyes to this big glaring problem. And the glaring problem is this. One-third, and this is an actual statistic, one-third of all medical healings, which include surgery and drugs and all the other kinds of therapies, one-third of all healings are due to the placebo effect. The placebo effect is the belief that the mind has, that it can heal itself by going through whatever surgery or drug treatment plan or whatever it is, the belief in the mind in the practice is going to heal them. That the mind says, I know that this is the thing that's going to heal me. And this causes the healing. So one-third of all healing had nothing to do with the medical treatment at all. One-third, all of it, has to do with the mind, and called the placebo effect. It's interesting, medical students get that information in their medical training. It's probably presented in all of about a 10-minute presentation, which is then quickly, you know, forgotten as the rest of the courses go on because the mind is systematically excluded in conventional biology, because conventional biology is based on physical reality, chemicals, molecules, and signals being carried by the substance of chemistry. So
we'll talk a lot more about the placebo effect in the next hour. But we are talking about mind, and we're talking about maybe the mind physically being spread out over the whole body. And
well, I agree with you the first time that I don't think mind is localized physically. It's an energy field. I don't think we can localize it that much.
But energy is interacting with molecules, and these, I think, molecules are in the form of proteins in certain orders and pairs, and they sort of become the blueprint for the physical body. But I don't really know, except from reading your book, but how many different kinds of proteins are we talking about in the human body?
There are over 150,000 different proteins, and some people would speculate up to a million, so I have to say minimum 150,000 and a lot more possibly.
Well, these proteins, they're synthesized by growing fetus to allow the total organism to materialize as a combination of traits from heredity.
They're the building blocks.
Yeah, so DNA carries the pattern for making the proteins. A lot of people ask the question, okay, where did DNA come from? I don't know if we can ask. That's a difficult one.
Well, the answers are not very good right now. There's a suggestion that it came from RNA, because the important thing was there were living organisms in biology here before there was DNA.
Right.
And so they're talking about what is called an RNA world, where RNA is like an interface between proteins and DNA. And so that apparently it came from that, and my speculation is that the proteins were actually the precursor of the DNA. The DNA is a memory, and it's taken from something, and so I would really say that the proteins that were functional led to a template that was recognized as RNA, which then became DNA. Many people are starting with the RNA, but I think the proteins probably came first.
Yeah, and as these proteins are synthesized, I mean, they have to be remade all the time because cells die and things have to be replicated, and they're made by our bodies every second of every day, and sometimes there are these engineering changes. So how many aspects of our environment can affect these processes? Well, I mean, everything does.
Everything
does. Sound. Everything.
Every part of the environment, the local environment, the global environment, and the environment in the solar system.
That's cool.
The fields in the solar system are very influential to the shaping of the proteins on the planet.
I ran across this experiment a number of years ago. I read about it, and I saw something similar in your book, where healthy mice were given a drug that makes them develop diabetes. Then the mice were bred. The pups spontaneously developed diabetes. Why? It wasn't in the genes of the parents. This is something that happened to them after they were already bred.
This is, we're hitting on the topic that to me is like the most exciting piece of new science in hundreds of years. And it's a process called epigenetic control. Epigenetic control. It's different than when you and I went to school, what I was teaching medical students, for example, was called genetic control, which is most people, that's what they're taught. Genetic control literally says control by genes. The new science is called epigenetic control, And what's wonderful about it is that the prefix epi means above. Like when you say the word epidermis, that literally means the layer above the dermis, the outer layer. So epi is above. So when I say epigenetic control, literally it says control above the genes. And this is such blow-away information, and it was part of it. Well, it actually was founded before the human genome results were reported, but then made sense of the genome project. And here's where the problem went wrong. Our conventional belief going in to making up the human genome is that the human body would contain, in the human cell, would contain over 100,000 genes. And the simple reason for that belief was that every gene was a blueprint to make a protein. And so every different protein has its own gene to make it. Well, with over 100,000 different proteins, it would automatically imply, well, you must have over 100,000 genes, one for each of the proteins. So when the results came in, Brooks, the results were exciting because when the results came in, instead of over 100,000 genes, there were less than 23,000 genes. And all of a sudden, there was like this big monkey wrench in the machine. It says, how could you make 150,000 different proteins with only 23,000 genes? Now we know, and here's what it's all about. The genes are like blueprints with sections that like plan A, B, C, and D that are linked together. And that what the epigenetic control process is, it can cut and dice the instructions and repatch them in different ways. So you start with a single blueprint, but by cutting and splicing and patching, you can make, listen to this number, 30,000 different variations from the same original blueprint.
Wow.
And all of a sudden it says, well, what can you do with the genes? The answer is you can make 30,000 times different number of products than every gene you have. And all of a sudden you start to realize, my God, that's, you know, such a massive amount of creation. And the answer is yes, and the creation is based on how the cell responds to the environment. So as a cell responds to the environment, it has the ability to edit and alter the genetic print from the gene up to 30,000 different ways based on what's going on in the world. So there was this one belief, we are programmed pre-programmed, determined by our genes. And now it turns out, my God, with 30,000 variations on every gene, nothing is determined. It's continuously, dynamically changing the genes and the readout of the genes as we experience our lives. An interesting experiment that substantiates this in a beautiful way is they looked at the readout of the genes in two identical twins, as siblings, identical siblings. The moment identical twins are born, they're pretty much reading the same sets of genes. Just to make sense for some of the people who don't understand, we don't read all the genes. For the reason is this, we've got two complete sets of genes in each cell. One set of genes from the mother and one set from the father. You don't use all of them, so it's sort of like you pick some from column A and some from column B, and then you make the final thing. So it changes all of the time in some sense. Well, they found out when they looked at identical twins, at the moment of their birth, they were pretty close to having the exact same readout. But as they followed their lives over days and months and then years, they then would look at the readout down the road and found out that the twins, the readout from identical twins, the genetic readout would diverge profoundly one from the other based on their personal experiences. So basically it said, you come with a set of genes, but what happens to them are totally based on what you do with your life. And why that's important is old belief, the one most people have now, is you're a victim. Why? Well, you didn't pick the genes. You can't change the genes, and apparently the genes control your life. So you live with it the best you can. You're a victim of your genes. The new biology says, my God, no, you're the master, because it's how you respond to life. Since you can control the way you respond to life, you have the ability and the power to control your genetic readout. Now you become a master. But if you don't know this, then you're just a victim by being ignorant of this. And that's the big problem, because the genes are adjusted to your perceptions of the world. And if I give you a perception that you have cancer in your family, that's what you believe, then that belief alone can actually stimulate the production of cancer.
And
that's because, and all of a sudden you see, well, I'm the master, but without knowing I was the master, I could also end up destroying the machine, not knowing that how powerful I was with my thoughts and how influential they were in the readout of the cells.
We're going to get into this a lot more in the next hour, so don't go away. 1 hour gone, 2 hours to go. My guest, Dr. Bruce Lipton, his website is brucelipton.com. We'll be back after these messages. Don't go away. It's going to get a lot deeper than this. Talk to you soon. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're here with Dr. Bruce Lipton, starting our second hour of three. We don't want you to miss a thing. An asteroid hurtling toward Mars
has a 1 in 28 chance of walloping the red planet on the 30th of January, according to the latest calculations. The rock's discovery just a couple of months before a possible impact begs the question of what would happen if it were instead headed for Earth. With so little warning, the only option would be to evacuate any inhabited areas it might hit, astronomers say. The asteroid, called 2007 WD5, is an estimated 50 meters across, putting it in the same class as the Tunguska object that exploded over Siberia in 1908, flattening trees in an area extending many kilometers from the explosion. Don Yeomans, head of NASA's Near-Earth Object Program at Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, estimates that it would take months to years to build a spacecraft that could deflect an asteroid and prevent it from hitting Earth. Scientists are still debating the best method for deflecting asteroids, considering everything from firing lasers at them to nudging them off course with a gravity tractor. But if an object in a scenario similar to that of 2007 WD5 was discovered just a few weeks ahead of a potential collision with Earth, there would not be enough time to mount a deflection mission. In our last hour with Dr. Lipton, I think we'll just call him Bruce, we started talking about the environment and how it affects the cell membrane, and we were talking about proteins and how it appears that we have many hundreds of thousands of proteins that make up the human body, but only about 20 to 25,000 genes. And so the idea that each gene could make as many as 30,000 different proteins from itself sort of lends itself to the idea that perhaps, even though we've been given a certain genetic bag, we can make of it what we want. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour. And how maybe that might be done. We'll try not to get so metaphysical, because we're trying to be scientific here. So let's step up to the next level of biology. Let's get past the cells and into the molecular biology of a being. This is where it all happens anyway. I mean, Bruce, you said earlier that the cell membrane really is the brains of the cell. So how does this really happen on a molecular level? I mean, you said it was a liquid crystal, but how on a molecular level does this happen? Are these phospholipids, how do they actually make up the cell membrane and act like that?
Well, the cell membrane is like a bread and butter sandwich with two pieces of bread and a thick slab of butter in the center. And as a result of that butter layer, if you make a membrane go all the way around the cell and you have a butter layer, since water doesn't easily go through butter, then everything inside this membrane would be separated from everything on the outside of the membrane, because the butter is a barrier. Well, the membrane has this butter-like structure, but built into this bread and butter sandwich are like olives with channels running through them. And these olives can open and close, and as they open and close, they can let stuff go from one side of the cell membrane to the other side of the cell membrane. Because of this ability, then the olives control the environment inside of the cell by letting in things or preventing things from coming in, so that the environment inside the cell is controlled. And that's the requirement for life. You have to have a place where you can control the environment. So, for example, as a human, we have to live in certain temperature ranges, otherwise we can't live, and we have to have water, otherwise we can't live, so there's precise environment. And so inside the cell, the environment is maintained by this bread and butter and olive sandwich where the olives open and close, letting things in. Well, some of the things it lets in are the equivalent of information. It sends in molecules like hormones and growth factors and things like that that control functions inside the cell. So by opening and closing these channels, and then you say, well, how does a channel, which is a protein, open and close? And then we go to the fact that proteins are like the magic molecule, because life comes from proteins. And the reason why? Proteins are molecules that can change their shape. They're like shapeshifters. they're like long strands, like wire sculpture, where you take a piece of wire and you can bend it and twist it in such a way that you make a little sculpture out of it. That's actually what a protein looks like. And if you change the electromagnetic environment around one of these protein wire sculptures, it actually undoes itself and rewraps itself into a different shape. So all of a sudden, it just basically concludes with, we have a building block molecule called a protein that can respond to signals in the environment by changing its shape. And why that's important is because in changing shape, a molecule moves, and from movement, that's where life comes from. So proteins are the molecules that take structure and allow it to express activities and behaviors that lead to the production of life. So proteins do this, they're physical molecules, but they respond to electromagnetic fields.
Well, is this hardwired into the genetic code, or is this something that can be learned by the individual, like the mice pups learn diabetes from their parents?
Well, what we now know is built into the cells is a device that can take a DNA blueprint and rewrite it very specifically, rewrite the blueprint. And it does it, every time it rewrites it, it introduces mutations. And you say, well, why would you want to do that? And the answer is because then every time you make a copy, you get a variation that didn't exist before. So it's sort of like, you know how a group of people get together and they do brainstorming, and they say they need to solve a problem, and then everybody sits there and somebody throws out an idea and somebody else throws out an idea, and pretty soon the whole board's covered with ideas, and then somewhere out of those ideas come the solution. And cell, the genes in a cell, when a cell is stressed, will do this brainstorming function where it makes all these different copies with the expectation one of these copies is going to make a better protein to get me out of this issue. And when it does, if it can create a better copy of the gene, then the system can take the old gene out, the one that wasn't working very good, and cut it out and insert the new gene. And so what that means is, as the environments change, organisms can keep changing their genetics and rewriting them to fit the environment so that they can survive, so that evolution is a continuous ongoing process that changes with what's going on in the world around us. But it's also not an accident in the sense that what evolves was somewhat already determined by what the environment offered. That's a complicated way of saying that evolution is not a random process, but is more or less a mechanism of adaptation to complement the environment. So if you could understand the environment, you can have a predictive nature about where evolution is going to go based on the environment. So, for example, this process of making variations is used in the immune system. And what's the immune system? Well, it's actually the functional use of this evolution mechanism in our biology for this reason. A foreign object, a foreign bacterium, a foreign virus, something that could cause havoc in our system gets inside our body. The system's never seen it before, but here's this new structure that exists. Well, the immune system is designed to glom on to these new structures and make a perfect fit, like an adjustment where you can make a protein that's like a perfect tool that grabs onto this foreign structure. Well, the protein, this perfect tool, doesn't exist before the foreign structure got there. What the immune system does is takes an antibody gene and then adjusts and modifies the gene till the protein that it makes is a perfect tool. Why that's relevant is then, oh, I can predict the evolution of the immune system. If I inject into you a smallpox virus, then I can tell you that in 3 days, you will have antibodies that will be a perfect physical complement to that virus. And so all of a sudden it's like, well, that's not random. I know exactly where it's going to go. Or if you take bacteria and throw them into a solution with like petroleum, like an oil spill, and you cultivate these bacteria in this very toxic environment, a lot of them die off, but a number of them live because they start to adjust their genes to make little protein tools that will glom onto that oil and break it down and use it for food. So the industrial people know the evolution of the bacterium before they create it because they set up the environment and then put a bacterium in it and wait until the bacterium adapts to the environment, in this case, eating up the oil spill. And so they predicted the outcome of that evolution. So
we didn't evolve
by chance.
That's completely fascinating. So when the body has a histamine reaction or a rash or a fever, this is the response of the cells of the body to a certain environmental signal. It's trying to brainstorm, as it were, to figure out a way to rid itself of that stimulus, right?
It responds to that, yes, because it sets up a protein tool, and it's a receptor that, if that signal shows up, then it will make a response to it. But now we throw a little bit of a sticky thing in here, but it's very exciting for this reason, that allergens are generally not toxic. They're things that are not toxic, but we make them toxic, meaning some people, strawberries, no problem at all. Other people take a strawberry and break out in hives because the immune system is responding to the strawberries. And the issues are, well, why do these occur? And a lot of it has to do with the way we respond to the environment. One of the clearest examples, because it's a common one, is, let's say, this couple have this romance together, and one of them has a dog. So let's say the guy comes into the relationship and the girl has a dog, and they have the romance, and then it breaks up and it doesn't go well. They split up, and then shortly afterward this guy gets an allergy to dogs. And the reason is there's an emotional content to the immune system. And this is also exciting for this reason, because it also is very important to the placebo effect that we talked about, that in studying the immune system, they were looking for where's the ultimate control. So you start with, well, the immune system controls itself. But then they started to find that signals sent by the brain to the immune cells and picked up by this keyboard on the surface of the immune cells, these signals can control the function of the immune system. So the next level of control said, oh, it's not the immune system controlling itself, it's the nervous system controlling the immune system. So the new field was then called neuroimmunology. And then they started to find out, yeah, but it wasn't just the brain that was controlling the immune system, but it was related to the emotional characters of the individual. So all of a sudden they changed the name, and now the new field is really correctly called psychoneuroimmunology. And the reason why that's important is the basis of the placebo effect, is that the mind absolutely controls the immune system. And it controls it when we're having a healthy immune system and a healthy response, but it's also controlling it when we have allergies and self-destructive illnesses, because our mind is, again, involved with that immune system. And then you say, but why would the mind do that? And then we go back and say, well, remember that mind? We said it was a dictator. It could be a benevolent dictator, or it could be a despot. It's interesting, because most autoimmune diseases, when you translate autoimmune into English, it means self-destructive. And it's very interesting, because many of the diseases that we're finding that are very self-destructive are autoimmune diseases, like diabetes, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, are parts of the immune system that are attacking self. And you say, but why would you attack self? And then, of course, it says, well, what's the belief of the mind? I mean, all I have to do is suggest to how many people out there have ever said to themselves, talking to themselves, I wish I was dead, don't realize... Be very careful of what you ask for, because the mind is controlling the biology, and this is especially true of the immune system, because we can turn on our immune system, protect us, or we can shut it off deliberately and allow ourselves to succumb to disease, and this becomes very important, because we've been led to believe that we're victims of all this, but we haven't put our mind into it, and we really need at some point to elaborate on the nature of this mind because people say, yeah, but I don't have it in my mind to get myself sick. Why did I get sick? And then that's where we have to talk about the, I don't know if you're ready to talk about that yet, Brooks, or not, but the nature of the subconscious and the conscious mind then become a relevant topic.
Oh, yeah, they definitely do. I recall in your book, and I think I've read about it before, where Pasteur was revealing that cholera was caused by microbes, which was, you know, soundly rejected, just horribly rejected by the medical community. And to prove it, one of his associates, I can't remember what his name was now, grabbed the vial full of cholera. I guess it's a virus or an organism.
Bacterium.
Bacterium. He swallowed it. Well,
yeah.
You would think in a matter of hours this guy's going to contract cholera and then die a horrible frothing death. But nothing happened to him.
I know. Science dismissed that because they couldn't explain it, so they just said, well, it didn't really happen. So it's sort of like a spontaneous healing. They can't explain it, so when they can't explain it, it didn't really exist. And the problem with that is, over the years, there's so many of those can't explain it that at some point you have to say, maybe they don't understand something, and that's because it really comes down to they still look at the biology as something run by genes, so all the power's in the genes, and they have ignored the role of the mind in controlling the readout of the gene. So epigenetics brings this into play, the influence of the mind. And yet, what we talked about is that there are two parts to the mind, and this is where the confusion comes from, and especially where the distortion about positive thinking comes in, because there's two parts of the mind, one called the subconscious mind, the mind that operates without you paying any attention to it, allows for you to breathe, allows for you to walk. You can even drive your car. It's a programmable mind. And so before you got driving lessons, of course, you can't drive the car automatically. But once you've had the lessons and once you've practiced it and it becomes a habit, then a lot of us, and I have to include myself in here big time, can drive a car and get, let's say, involved with a discussion with somebody and for about 10 minutes be so captivated by the discussion, then look out the window and realize, my God, I haven't paid attention to the road for the last 10 minutes because my consciousness was tied up in this discussion. Who drove the car? And the answer is the subconscious mind. Because once it was taught how to drive a car, it could do it by itself. Most of our lives, in fact, it is now recognized that 95% or more of the day, almost all of our behavior, 95% of our behavior is coming from habit programs in the subconscious mind. And
wow.
That the other mind is called the conscious mind. And it's interesting because, well, the subconscious mind is essentially the entire brain structure because it was there before consciousness evolved as a character. So you say, what's the subconscious mind? I said, well, almost the entire brain. It controls all the automatic processes of the body and learned habits, like the dog will salivate when the bell rings because it's a learned habit. And so the subconscious mind's function is that. And consciousness became a part of our system with the development of the what is called the prefrontal lobes, just two little small parts of the brain in the front behind the forehead. And this is where the seat of consciousness, so it evolved as a special application of the brain, this conscious part, self-conscious part, the self-aware, the self part that has the identity that when I speak of my spiritual self or my personal identity or Brooks, you as an individual, that's an awareness in the self-conscious mind. The other mind is just the machine to respond to the world. There's food, eat it, or whatever you need, get it. That mind does that, but the thinking, rational, logical part is this little add-on device at the front of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. Now, the difference between the two, as I said, is the subconscious mind's function is just habits and reflexes. That's all it does. You hit the knee with a hammer, it kicks the leg, you don't have to think about it, it's automatic. But the conscious mind is the part that the individual entity with a thinking and rational thought can actually control any function of the body. Even though it's a small part of the brain, with consciousness, like yogis that experience this, they can regulate their heartbeat, they can regulate blood pressure, they can regulate their pH with their conscious mind. So it's very powerful in that regard, but it's a small piece of the apparatus, so it only handles a small processing, it's a small amount of functioning. In other words, if I said, if you were like doing a chore, watching a television show and reading an article, you can handle about those three things easily enough. But if someone then came to the door and then you had to get involved with a discussion, the conscious mind wouldn't be able to handle every one of these processes. So the conscious mind is very limited in the number of different things it can do, but it's not limited in its power of the things that it does do. So it is very powerful, but it can't do too many things. The subconscious mind is our saving grace because, for example, if you want to walk and talk, if you didn't have a subconscious mind program of how to walk, and you had to walk like an infant did, you'd spend most of your day trying to feel which muscles are contracting and try to stay in balance. You wouldn't have time to be doing any talking. Your mind, the processing it takes to walk, the nervous processing, is an amazing amount of work. But once you learn it,
it's automatic. We don't want to add too much to it. I mean, for instance, don't try chewing gum and doing those two things.
Oh, no, that's the third one. That one throws you off balance. But the fun part about it is then it says this. Two facts of math. Number one, the subconscious mind, as an information processor, physical information processor, is 1 million times more powerful a processor than is the conscious mind. That's what the conscious mind can process, but it's limited. And number two, the subconscious mind works 95% of the day or more. So that means that when you're trying to control your life with positive thinking, you're using this little tiny processor that works less than 5% of the day to try to control your biology. And the issue is, it's usually not very, you don't have enough focus to do that. And so the moment you take your eye off what you're trying to do, then it goes back to the automatic processor. And the automatic processor is the way you've done it your whole life. So if you're trying to change something in your life, you're really trying to change the program in the subconscious mind. If in fact what you want with your conscious mind is supported by your subconscious mind, positive thinking will work very well because both minds agree. But when positive thinking fails, it's because what you want in your conscious mind is generally not supported by what's programmed in your subconscious mind.
Well, then therein lies the challenge for all of us. We have to find a way, or the challenge for the new, evolved, you know, peaceful, loving human being is to find a way to at least communicate between the conscious and subconscious, but maybe more preferably to be able to re-script or rewrite some of the automatic in-the-now programming in the subconscious with something we consciously want to happen.
And that's a requirement for our survival. That's a requirement for this planet to stay alive at this point, is to rewrite some of the habitual programs that we play without seeing them that are very self-destructive. And the problem with the subconscious, I usually in a lecture give this example that most people understand what I'm talking about, and the point is that we rarely see our subconscious programs for the following reason. Remember, the subconscious and conscious work as a tandem duo. Whatever the conscious is focusing on, it has absolute control over. If it wants to change the blood pressure, it can change it. If it focuses on that, for sure. And the subconscious will run all the other chores. Whatever the conscious mind is not paying attention to, the subconscious mind can do all the other chores. So you can walk around without thinking about the walking, or all you have to do is have an intention, and your biology will get you there without you having to think about how. Or when you're driving the car and having a conversation, the car is driving, you're driving it for 10 minutes, and then you look out the window and realize you haven't paid attention to the road, and you say, yeah, well, my mind was engaged in this conversation, but I asked this question. I say, yeah, well, but while your mind was engaged in that conversation, describe the driving behavior that you just went through for the 10 minutes, and you'd have to say,
I
didn't see it. I was talking,
I wasn't there. I was just a passenger behind the wheel.
But the catch ends up is that we rarely see our own behavior. So, like in the lecture, I give this example. I say, say you know somebody and you know their parent. and you recognize that your friend shares the same behavior that their parent has. And then you volunteer something like, you know, Mary, you're just like your mom. And then, of course, the first thing you do, you have to back away from Mary because she looks at you and it's like, how could you even compare me to my mom? And most people are very familiar with that, but it's humorous, but it's profoundly important for this reason.
We're about an hour and a half through the program, and I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines for the next hour and a half. In the U.S., you can call toll-free at 888-228-4494. Anywhere in Canada, you can call us toll-free. We've got our number for you, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else on the planet, we have a lot of listeners in Australia and Europe. You can reach us at 530-776-5154. Or 776-5185, or 776-9916. And if you're listening and want to call in on Skype, you can reach us at just BBS Radio. And if you're listening and want to call in on Pal Talk, you can call us at BBSRadio_com. Our Instant Messenger and AIM are not working tonight. We just have the one computer running here in the studio. So you'll have to reach us by telephone. So the phone lines are now open, and we'll accept calls from anywhere in the world. I also wanted to let you know that the next 2 weeks we will be running archives again. I hate to say that, but I'm not going to be where I can reach the radio. So we'll hopefully post some things on the website so that you can get to it. That's at x2-radio.com. We are a proud member of the BBS Radio Network and also of the new STLI Radio Network, courtesy of Kevin Smith. We want to welcome everyone that's listening on those two networks. With the bringing together of those two networks, X Squared Radio may be the largest internet radio program on Earth. We intend to make it a little larger, especially if we keep attracting great guests like Bruce. So we are at a quandary here because I do maybe observe people who don't have 95% of their life running in the unconscious. They have 99.9% of their life running in the unconscious. They don't realize that they're behind the wheel at all. Nevertheless, they are affecting the universe, and they are affecting their own health. So let's talk about, in the next hour and a half, how we, I know you've laid some groundwork, you know, for the final hour here, but we can go ahead and get into it now. There seems to be a modern medical culture that says drugs and surgery are the only cure for what ails us. You know, give us the short version of how methods are approved for treatment by the medical community. How does the FDA go through that process, and how do they do their clinical trials, and how they select people for clinical trials? How does that work?
Well, basically, they start with, an experimental drug, and they want to say, see if this has any value. So they select a group of people, supposedly random, but it turns out now they're actually a little wiser than that. Supposedly random, though, so that you give the people this drug to treat whatever the symptoms are that these people have, and then you score the effectiveness of this drug in alleviating those symptoms. And if it's better than the placebo, meaning one group of the people just get a sugar pill, let's say, if this drug proves to be better than the placebo, and it didn't have to be much better than a percent better than the placebo effect, then this drug is suggested as an active agent as a treatment for that process. Well, the problem with that, this whole thing is so fraught with issues, especially when one-third of the people are all affected by sugar pills in the first place. You can't get accurate data to that extent. Yes.
Well, I find it completely fascinating. I mean, before we get into the why and how this happens, let's consider the data here. We're You're saying a third of the people in the study are given something fake, like sugar pill or starch or something that certainly would not have any, you know, medicinal value.
That's your test pill. That's your comparison pill, because that should have no effect. So you start with a group where you just give them a fake pill, because you want to say, this is it just the taking of the pill, or is it the content of the pill? So the first separation is, how many people have an effect by just taking the pill? And it turns out one-third do. One-third of the people will actually heal themselves as good or better than taking the pill, without any more than the belief. Let me give you just an interesting fact about this, Brooks, is that is the one of the largest selling drugs on this planet today is something like Prozac.
Right.
Prozac has been demonstrated by laboratory tests to be no better than a sugar pill in effectiveness. In the laboratory test.
Sure makes a lot of money. Sure they're not.
Exactly. And it also, because of the negative side effects, it also costs, it's more costly than giving a sugar pill.
Not many.
So that it's very interesting. I mean, billions of dollars are going into Prozac when it actually tests in a market no more effective than a sugar pill.
And yet the sugar pill has no side effects.
No side effects. But you see, Prozac is a good placebo. You say, what do you mean by that? And it's like, it encourages the belief of healing because it has side effects. When you take the Prozac, there's a physiological effect. You can feel it in your body. Well, why that's relevant is it pushes the placebo effect, because if some people are thinking, you know, in that level, this drug is going to help me or not, but all of a sudden feel the drug doing something that enhances their belief that, oh, it's working, I feel it now. And so it's an interesting placebo, because they added a new twist to it. If you can give a side effect that is experienced, then it gives the person's mind a boost that it is now working and makes the placebo effect work better.
All right, let's step beyond drugs then. You discussed in your book a similar study with corrective knee surgery. Tell us about the knee surgery story.
Well, this is Dr. Mosley in Houston, Texas, and he's like one of the world's experts on this arthroscopic surgery. A lot of people have joint problems in the knee as they get older, and what the surgeon wanted to find out was there were actually two parts to the operation. They make an incision on either side of the knee, and part one is they put in tubing and wash out the joint fluid. So they're flushing the fluid, and then secondly, through one of the incisions, they put one of these little micro scalpels where they go in and scrape the surface smooth, or smooth as they can with this little scraper at the joint, so to smooth out the joint. So the question that the surgeon wanted to find out was how effective was the flushing out and how effective was the scraping part toward the healing. So we designed the experiment, and yet the woman that was in charge of his division said, yeah, but you have to include the equivalent of a placebo, you know, where you just do a fake operation. He says, "What? I'm a surgeon. Operations do things because they're physical. What are you talking about?" And she said, "And you must perform the equivalent of what they call a sham or fake operation." So he started to do this by having his patients get sedated, and they're not knocked out. What he did is he cut two incisions. He actually cut two incisions, but he didn't do the flushing out or the scraping. But he played a videotape on the monitor so that as the patient was in the sedated state, he could observe that and listen to the conversation that they were doing the operation. And if he looked up at the monitor, he could see that something was going on. So, but they never really did anything. It was just fake. And it turns out that there was no difference in any of the groups, the ones that were flushed out, the ones that were scraped, or the ones that were given the sham operation. In other words, the surgeon was just blown away by the reality that the surgery actually had no effect beyond the placebo. And it was like, oh, my God, that even there's a thing called, you know, surgical placebo in this case. It was a very exciting finding. Because it said that the surgery wasn't really necessary, it was just the belief in the surgery that really created the healing.
Well, one of the things that amuses me, and I'm not morbid about it, but it amuses me, is I see the the drug company's advertisements on TV. You know, take this and it will lower your cholesterol level. Take this and you'll have better performance in bed or whatever. And then they talk about the side effects very quickly, and they're kind of printed at the bottom there. Now, I guess if you could freeze frame it or download the actual clinical study, one of the side effects is always death. I mean, we always talk about that. Okay, for 99.99% of the people, you're going to have the results, but of course there are the 1%, the 1/10, the 1% that die. So here we have statistics that establish that people have been cured of all types of ailments, including this arthritic knees, by thinking their way to health. In fact, the cures were long-term and had zero side effects. Nobody died as a result of curing themselves, right?
Right.
Okay.
Now, wouldn't you think it would be an interesting research effort to find out what was the foundation for all those healings? Because
yeah.
if we can understand the foundation for those healings, then maybe by enhancing whatever it was, we can get it past third, one-third is without even knowing anything about it. If we started with one-third and pushed it to two-thirds or more, that means we could essentially cut the medical budget by two-thirds right now, because one-third is wasted. One-third is absolutely spent on the placebo effect. One-third of all the money is all placebo.
This is something that really has always perturbed me. I've been in science now for 30 years, commercial scientist, and I'm often called in because companies are just at their wits' end. They just don't know what to do. And yet, every single time I go in as a consultant, I go through the data that they already collected from their already years of measurements, and I find the answer. Because
we have a caller.
Regularly, in the science community, they throw out data that doesn't fit their paradigm.
Absolutely.
It would be one thing if there were 2 or 3%, but 30%? That is statistically significant. So why is there not a Nobel Prize in medicine for the person who, like you say, raises this one-third to two-thirds with no side effects and no incisions and no drugs? Now that
I haven't answered it, but I'll answer it in this question to you. Are you aware, Brooks, that there are other ways of providing energy that are far more efficient than burning fossil fuel?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes or no?
I
asked you the question, where are they?
Well, the answer is the same
regarding the study on the placebo effect, for the simple reason that the system has been overtaken by the corporate interests of the pharmaceutical industry and the HMO people. And as a result, their effort is to make money. If I could heal you without using the drugs, nobody makes any money. So therefore, there is no research funded into these alternative understandings about the placebo effect, because there is no return for the drug companies to support that research.
I understand.
And that's,
I think we have a
the
caller.
Same reason why there's no other alternative energies out there right now as well. Not
well,
in the interest
there,
of the petroleum.
There is, and we'll talk about it in a second, but we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
I'm from Virginia, and I guess I could say my name is Pranoya. I called like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back.
Yeah. Good. I'm very interested because I've actually emailed. I think I emailed you a long time ago. Not you, Agnew, the other guy. I forgot his name.
Oh,
Lipton.
Bruce Lipton. Yeah.
Lipton, Bruce Lipton, yeah, I emailed you one time, and you had someone else to email me back, because I know you're really, really busy.
It got busy. I used to do it all myself, but it got busy.
the one, when I was listening to this, and I have research, I've even gone on your website, I even went to your MySpace. And
wow, that's pretty thorough.
I've always been, I'm a researchologist, I guess you can tell. I've had brain surgery. I get a check every month for the rest of my life. So I have to be productive in some way, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so I've had brain surgery, so I've almost died from that. But I was always thinking that if I didn't have brain surgery, they had to do surgery on me, because the kind of tumor I had was an astrocytoma. And astrocytoma
mm-hmm.
is the number one killer. And
right.
It's even the tumor that was in the movie Phenomenon with John Travolta.
I remember that,
it's
right.
It's kind of interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting. So, I'll tell you, in reality, I guess I do have those abilities, except I haven't actually found out how to do them. I know that, but they know. I know they exist.
I do too.
Okay.
I guess that, and I've not taken any drugs because I'm over it. I'm on Medicare. I don't care about Medicare. I don't care about actually putting anything in my system besides water and food.
Far better thinking than any other thing in there.
I know. And I was just thinking, though, if I really had it in my head when I had this tumor in my head, that I would not be affected by it. If I really had full faith in that, do you think that would have happened? Because if
absolutely,
it's all in your head, I know that.
But I agree it would happen, but then as I mentioned before, I said if that thought would be in your conscious mind, that's the one that's thinking, okay, I'm going to think this positive thought that this is not going to be in my life, I'm going to take care of it. And I said, that's really good. But if you have a belief system in your subconscious mind that doesn't support that, then it's not going to be very effective. And I'll give you an example of that.
Okay.
Is that in growing up, many people in their developmental experiences, every time they get sick, their parents say, oh, you're sick, we have to take you to the doctor. And this is a learning period during the child's development that what it acquires is a subconscious belief that says that the doctor is the one that does the healing. The doctor is the professional. The doctor makes the opinion. And why that's relevant is it interferes with their own healing, and this is the joke part. Many people actually get well on the way to the doctor. And the reason is we can heal ourselves. That's an innate ability to do that. But when we buy the belief that we have to see the doctor, then we put that as a stepping stone before healing can occur. And that's why just going to the doctor for many people is enough to start the healing. But the point with you and that I'm talking about is this. We also buy the belief that the doctor's opinion is the truth. He's the professional and who are we? And why that's relevant is if that's the belief in the subconscious mind, and the doctor tells you you have some prognosis, and the subconscious mind is controlling the show 95% or more of the day, then that's
right.
The belief that's programming your biology, no matter what your little, the 5% that's coming from your conscious mind wishes for, the 95% and million times more powerful subconscious is the one with the control. So, could you have healed yourself? And the answer is, I really believe you could have, but you first would have had to make sure that the beliefs in your subconscious are supporting you. And conventionally, you can't ask your conscious mind can't ask your subconscious mind. They don't talk to each other that way. Subconscious mind is like a computer or hard drive. It's got programs already stored from habit in there, but you can't see it. You can't, it just responds when the buttons get pushed. So, it's very difficult. You have to identify what beliefs you hold in your subconscious mind. And if you make them in agreement with the desires in your conscious mind and reprogram them, then you are a very powerful force in your support. But if the subconscious programs don't agree, then it's an uphill battle, likely not to succeed very well. But if you're vigilant, you can hold it. But it's easier to learn how to change the subconscious.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I was just about to ask you, like, how can you reprogram your subconscious mind? How can you change your subconscious mindset?
That's a great question for this reason, is because we've held a belief, and this is where the problems come from most all of us in the world, and it comes from this. We've held a belief that the two minds, the conscious mind and subconscious mind, talk to each other all the time, so that if the conscious mind becomes aware of something, then the subconscious mind should become aware of it too. But here's the problem. No. They're two separate things. The subconscious mind is a habit learning record device. That's what it does. It learns from habit, it makes a recording. The conscious mind is the one with the thinking mind in it. So when you're talking to yourself, you're thinking that your conscious mind is going to be talking to your subconscious mind and fix it. The problem is, the subconscious mind is the equivalent of a tape recorder. So, for example, let's say I gave you a tape and you put in a tape player. And you push play, and the program's playing. That would be like the subconscious mind playing a program. And I say, but you don't like this program, so talk to this tape player and see how long talking to it before the tape changes the program. And the reality is you could talk until you're blue in the face. There's nobody in the tape player that's going to listen to you, so it'll never change that way. So the bottom line about it is that we have to recognize the subconscious mind does not have an entity in it. You can learn how to push the record button and rewrite the program, but by talking to it, which is what most of us have always done, son, or we go to, let's say, a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and you find out, oh, this person did that to you, your mom did that, your dad did that, and you learn all the reasons why you turned out this way. That's the conscious mind. It learned all the reasons. Did it change the subconscious mind? Not necessarily. That's why most people go through, become totally aware of whatever went wrong and still have the same lives afterwards. It's because learning it and having a desire and intention in your conscious mind does not necessarily change any of the program in the subconscious mind. So on my website, there's a brucelipton.com, there's a page called Resources. And I list a whole variety of new resources called energy psychology, which are new modalities that allow you to test the beliefs in your subconscious mind to see if they're in harmony with your health and your harmony and your desires that you want. And if the beliefs are not supportive, many of these modalities are the equivalent of pushing the record button and allowing you to rapidly rewrite the program. And that's the most exciting thing about these energy psychology modalities,
right,
is that
right. They
allow for changes in minutes. Something that affected your whole life can change on a dime, and you could walk away after 10 or 20 minutes of a process and have a completely different life. It's amazing. It's totally amazing.
Hey, I'll tell you right now, I'm already living a different life. I'm telling you, a long time ago, in like 2000, I had a really bad pain in my back, a pinched nerve, and I looked up at a picture of Jesus. I guess that's my subconscious mind thinking, you know, he's
right. The
healer. So next thing you know, I looked up at that picture and said, I didn't even say Jesus, I said, God, if you could do something, just one thing in my life, could you make this pain go away? And instantly, it vanished.
And that's because you gave up on it's like an epiphany, an awakening, okay, that all of a sudden you've opened up to another belief system. It's really very important. That's the power that belief has, and that's one way of doing it. It's an epiphany. My life changed in a similar kind of fashion. It wasn't something that I read about for a while, and then one day said, "Oh, look, I believe in spirit." After having a whole scientific career of being a spiritual, one day when I saw how it all worked, it was like, "Oh my God! There, by requirement, there's a spiritual thing." And boom, my life changed. It wasn't like a lot of practice. It was an event that can change your life.
It's kind of interesting that he tells a story in his book, The Biology of Belief, that he was in an airport and realized he was going to be in the air for a long time and he needed something to read. So in a rush, he goes to the airport bookstore and buys a book called The Cosmic Code, which is about quantum physics, which, as we all know, biologists have an innate fear of quantum physics.
I did.
and so he reads this book, and he can't put it down. And maybe the foundation of understanding quantum physics, at least from a lay point of view, laid the foundation for him to have this epiphany, which he later had when he got to the Caribbean doing his research. Now, that's pretty fascinating. So, you know, how many advances in medical pharmacology have been attributed to the quantum revolution?
Well, the exciting ones are, and the future is so bright with promise. That's why I'm so excited by it. It looks kind of dark, but that's just a transition as this new awareness of our own ability to control our genes and to control our lives, and to recognize why we seemingly had thought it was out of control because of that invisible subconscious. And we didn't talk about it, but the subconscious, the programs, the primary programs that are in the subconscious mind, we acquired from other people. Now, why is that important? The answer is this. Well, the conscious mind has your desires and your intentions, your aspirations, what you want from life. But the subconscious mind's got other people's programs that you downloaded during your childhood development.
Right,
and the issue is, if they don't support where you want to go, the subconscious being 95% of the operation means that other people's beliefs and attitudes are running your life, not your own. And that's where it's necessary to recognize the necessity of reprogramming, the limitations that most of us got when we were kids.
That's what people want to know. They want to know, is it possible?
Absolutely.
To introduce corrective or resonant energy while this process of folding and unfolding these proteins is going on, which is all the time, by the way, that we could write a new program on a cellular level.
Absolutely, and we do it, and it's absolutely wonderful, and sometimes we do that, we call it a spontaneous remission in some cases, where a person has been destined to die, and what do? Change their belief system. I'm not putting up with this, or I don't believe this, or I'm getting out of here. Whatever it was, they had a profound change in belief, and in that change of belief, the whole thing got spontaneously corrected.
Like the caller's back pain. I mean, he had a spontaneous remission of almost debilitating back pain from, I know, you know, people could believe, well, it was God stepping in and took that pain away from me, but perhaps there was a great resonating energy that he consciously brought up in his body. It resonated, maybe not identically, but resonated with his subconscious and had an immediate change.
This is how fast these things occur, because we go back to the proteins. The movement of the proteins generate behavior. So therefore, if the field is not appropriate, then the movement is affected in a negative way, and the behavior is consequently affected in a negative way. And you change the field, and the proteins respond in a different way, and life has a different character. So we can change things as fast as we can think about these changes.
Ah, thought. So part of this epiphany really, at least from what I digested from your book, does the being transcend the body?
Well, that was the big surprise to my life. I got into science to avoid the concept of spirituality as a kid. I remember these very pious spiritual people always giving advice, but when I looked at their lives, they never really looked that good. And I thought, you know, I prefer a different source of a truth, and that's where I gravitated to. Science became my hero. I remember as a kid, Einstein was like this like hero. I mean, he was like this funny looking guy, and he was like a people person, and he was like the most intelligent guy in the world. It was like I wanted that guy. So I went into science and left the spirit behind. But in going into the understanding of the cell membrane was a revelation that blew my mind. As I said, up till 1:59 in the morning in that Caribbean setting. I wasn't spiritual, and then when I understood that the cell membrane was the equivalent of a computer chip, and that on the surface were like a keyboard that responded to environment, I was already fully aware that what makes two people different from each other, and I say this on a biological context, meaning no two people are the same in this regard. If I put my cells into your body, Brooks, your immune system will say not self and reject it. Your cells are put into my body, my immune system says not self and will reject it. So obviously the first thing that's important is that our cells have some marker of self, because when the foreign cells are put in, the immune system can say, oh, these don't belong here, so there's an identity. And it turns out this identity is attributed to a bunch of protein antennas on the surface of the cell. These antennas are like television antennas in a miniature sense. They're receiving signals from the environment. And it turns out there are a group of these receptors that distinguish one person from another person. And that these receptors are like a combination code, and there's billions of variations on them. But here's the reality. The receptors, while being different, are not the cause of self, because the receptors are responding to a signal in the environment. So they're just a complement to a signal. It's with Einstein's phrase, we said, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle. Well, the self receptors are particles, but they're governed by a field called self. And all of a sudden I realized, my God, the little cells are like television sets. They're receiving a broadcast of self, and I'm playing like I am the broadcast playing through this physical television body. And what that all of a sudden led me to before 2 a.m., mind you, this in 1 minute from understanding the membrane as a chip, was that I said, oh, my God, then the receptors of self are downloading a signal of an identity. And why is that relevant? Because if the cell dies, that doesn't mean the identity, which was a broadcast, died. It's like a television. Like, you're watching a TV and the picture tube breaks and you say the television's dead. And it's like, true, it's dead, it doesn't work. But the question is, did the broadcast die with the television? The answer is no. And how do you know? And the answer is, you get another TV, you plug it in, you turn it on, but here's the most important part, you tune it to the station, and then the show is back on.
That's
well,
right.
What it turns out is each one of us is different than each other person because we have a set of antennas reading a broadcast that is different than the other person. So we're like this giant radio broadband spectrum here where each of us is reading our own little station out of the hole. And the issue about it is, yeah, but as receivers of the broadcast, if the receiver dies, the broadcast is still there. Yeah, but how do you know? And the answer is, a future body as a receiver shows up with the same frequency receptors. And guess what? It's like turning on the other television and tuning it to the station. The show is back on the air. And I realize, oh my God, my identity is an energy field, and it plays through this body, but it's a two-way street because not only am I sending information into the body to suggest where I want it to go and what I want it to do, but the body sends information back to my source. And it's funny because right around this time when all this came into my head, I was thinking of this question of, well, if I live in this spiritual energy world as well as a body, then why have both? And the answer sort of came from my own cells, which suggested to me, it was kind of funny when I think about it, my body was sort of saying, well, Bruce, if you're just a spirit without a body, what does chocolate taste like? What does a sunset look like? Or what does being in love feel like? And I realized,
yeah,
oh, my God,
feel like?
The body is a device. This is in simple terms, and this is the fun part. It's a spectrum analyzer. I put my body into this field, and I can see and smell and touch and taste, and all that information is picked up by my biology and sent to my nervous system in the form of vibrations. So I convert this experience of the world into electromagnetic vibrations that the brain is broadcasting. So all of a sudden,
Hold that thought. Oh, this is going to be great. As we prepare for our final hour and bring this most amazing revelation to you, listeners, I want you to consider this from Dr. Lipton's book. Energy signals are 100 times more efficient and infinitely faster than chemical signaling. What kind of signaling will your trillion-celled community prefer? Do the math, and we'll be back after these messages. My guest tonight is Dr. Bruce Lipton. His website, brucelipton.com. His book, The Biology of Belief. We have one more hour to go. Don't go away. We save the best for last. We'll be back after these messages. Our friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. but there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where I am currently building a biodiesel plant, converting canola seed, non-food, into diesel fuel, mean-burning, no-sulfur diesel fuel. We also have world leaders in algae for oil, which also just creates food and oxygen. I also want to let you know about Unlocking the Secret. We just recently went through editing. We've added all the pictures, the index, the table of illustrations. The book is coming out just a skunch under 500 pages. Should be going to the printer in about a week. So your wait will soon be over. The third book in the trilogy, Unlocking the Secret, will be coming out. And we also want to thank you, our folks down at NRG Research, for buying us out of stock of the TVT 24/7 engine oil energizer. As you know, those people that are putting that in their engines are ending their engine wear. I have over 340,000 miles on my Dodge Dakota, much to the chagrin of the new car salespeople. Astrophysics knows two solar activity cycles, one of 11 and 200 years. Both are caused by changes in the radius and area of the irradiating solar surface. The latest data say that Earth has passed the peak of its warmer period, and a fairly cold spell will set in quite soon. By 2012, actually, real cold will come when solar activity reaches its minimum by 2041 and will last for 50 to 60 years or longer. So don't throw away those warm coats and buy global warming stock just yet. Data, it doesn't lie. In this hour with my guest, Dr. Bruce Lipton, his great book, awesome book, reads very, very well. It was a national bestseller called The Biology of Belief. And his website is brucelipton.com. Bruce, how can people get the book? What's the easiest way?
Local bookstores, I hope, or Amazon is the least expensive way as far as I know.
Okay, very good. Everybody knows Amazon. We sell a lot of books there ourselves. In this hour, we're going to talk about energy and how it relates to healing. We want to open your mind to something amazing and true. I know you may have heard about the power of positive thinking or about group healing or one type of healing or another. Bruce has revealed after a lifetime of science and medical training that he is now a convert. I remember Tesla writing about how bad AC, alternating current, was for the body, and that it was actually DC fields that were good for the body. I have a friend named John Riley who runs a company called Lightstream, and he's the inventor and developer of a technology called the Lightstream Generator, and it bathes the body in a rotating DC magnetic field. Now, you wouldn't think that would do anything, but the documented health results are really quite amazing. But neither he nor I really know what is going on there. But one thing is clear. There is a strong interaction between energy of certain types and biology. So let's just start here. In the later 1800s, there was a trend in treatment called radiesthesia. Tell us how this got started, Bruce. Do you have any research on that?
Well, it was just basically a lot of electromagnetic work was into play at that time. And they started to recognize that charges could affect the functions of the body. Especially, I think the earliest one is when they actually hooked battery wires up to muscles and started to find that muscles would contract. That was Volta, I think, working, or Galvani, the galvanic response of putting power on and then watching the muscles contract. We started recognizing that there are influential fields that are involved with the healing. And back in the 30s, there was a lot of science published on this that actually, some famous work by a guy called Burr from, I think, Harvard, did a lot of work on fields and how it shaped cells and organs and that, living organisms were directly influenced by the surrounding fields. So,
how did the public respond to that? I mean, was it popular?
Well, it turned out to be one of those amazing things that I guess it became a fad for a while, and the people had parties where they would have electrical devices and they get to like soirees and heal themselves. And I think it got to the extent that it was like in the back of magazines, little ads, you'd become a radiesthesiast, it's $9.95, you get this little box with leads on it and an instruction book and you could be a healer. And the interesting fact is that indeed there was a great influence, but it wasn't really studied by science. In fact, it was purposely ignored by science because of science's restriction into the physical realm, tried to eliminate anything about the invisible because their belief was you would understand the universe just by studying the physical realm. So anything that was found to not be physical was considered not really relevant to understanding the body, and they shied away from it. They tried to ignore it. In fact, many doctors were using a lot of this radiesthesia equipment, and when the AMA formed in response to stuff like this, the American Medical Association, people unfortunately equate the AMA with like a government organization that looks after our health. That's an unfortunate misinterpretation. The AMA is a union of medical doctors, and their function is to support the profession of medicine. So it's a self-supporting system. And the issue was when they didn't they didn't get organized until sometime around this radiesthesia period, about the early part of the 1900s. And once they organized as a union, they made a clear statement that said that what they called science, it was relevant, and what they didn't look at was not relevant. So they clearly made a barrier and says, this is what we study, that's relevant. This is what we don't study, and that's not relevant. And in the not relevant camp was energy and magnetic fields and healing through all these other forms like chiropractic and homeopathy. They were all the outside ones. So the AMA made a strict ruling that doctors were not allowed to practice these things, and other people practicing these things then would be charged with practicing medicine without a license, so they outlawed all these forms and actually threw chiropractors and homeopathy people in jail for carrying out their practice in the 20s and 30s.
Wasn't there sufficient proof that energy and biology belong together?
This is the interesting part. In the literature, absolutely. But when it came to medical sciences, absolutely not. It was like they just closed their eyes and said it does not exist and we don't deal with it. And so, I mean, that was a hard act to do because they acknowledged the placebo effect and then immediately disregarded it. So that's how they accommodate things that don't fit what they want. It just doesn't play into the game.
Well, so what we're really talking about here is not really a health professional community then, are we? We're talking about something entirely different that would reject sound statistical data that supports these spontaneous healings and remissions and energy-based interactions between biology and, say, you know, magnetic fields that show promise for treatment. It would seem to me there has to be some other motivation here. So why is it you think that modern medicine rejected energy as a possible health treatment?
Because of the financial aspect of it as well as their original belief. You see, remember, science separated from religion by first acknowledging all it would study would be the physical realm. It originally said, if it's invisible, we leave that as metaphysics to the church, and therefore made its own barrier and then tried to live inside that barrier. But the problem was, as science started to unfold, it said that's a very artificial barrier because this invisible energy stuff, as quantum physics came to show us, is the shaper of the entire world. And yet medicine, when this started to come into the science, medicine has balked at adopting this, and then we'd have to go on and I say, why? And the answer, the best that I can see it, is it's not in the interest of the industry that makes money, and that's the health industry. It's not the medical doctors, it's the industry.
But what about the interest of people? I mean, people dying.
You Brooks. The interest of people is about the last thing that is on the minds of the corporate medicine. Corporate medicine is a corporation first. Medicine is a practice. And then you say, but what's the function of a corporation? The corporation exists to make money. So when you made medicine a corporate entity, then it lost its mission of healing and became a mission of returning money on stock investment. And then you have to say, well, how do you return money on stock investment? And the answer is, well, obviously, you must sell them things that they pay a lot of money for. And if I could tell you could heal yourself with your thoughts, nobody's going to make any money on that, so therefore they do not encourage it. I'll give you a perfect example. There's a Dr. Ornish in San Francisco, cardiovascular surgeon. And he did these experiments, which were published. And he took groups of cardiovascular patients, instead of doing the traditional path of giving them the medications that are conventionally prescribed, he took these patients and said, rather than medicine, I'm going to teach you how to undergo stress reduction techniques. I'm going to teach you about meditation. I'm going to give you programs on how to have a better diet and better social communication skills. In other words, he worked on these lifestyle things. Relevance, and this is blow away. This is mind-blowing. Conventional medicine if they can stop cardiovascular degeneration with drugs, that's called a success, okay?
Yeah.
Dean Ornish showed with his process where no drugs were used that not only did the cardiovascular degeneration stop in these patients, they actually regenerated their health. And medicine can't do that with the drugs. So you think, my God, this would be the future of all cardiovascular care. And it's funny because I saw Dean Ornish on a news interview on a television program, and he was very angry because he said, if I got the same results with a drug, every doctor in the world today would be prescribing this drug. He said, I got these results without drugs, and this has not even been taken into the medical community, even though the papers have been published. Basically, if you can't sell drugs, it doesn't come to the attention of the corporate medical people.
I have another clinical example. The live stream generator. I'm not really a designer of it. I'm a manufacturer. I'm an instrumental physicist. But I observed a woman who came in, and she was elderly. I don't really know how old, but obviously in her late 70s, and she was suffering from Parkinson's disease and had pretty severe tremors. Her right hand specifically really had high amplitude tremors. I mean, her hand was moving 8 to 10 inches and had not stopped for a long, long time. So, sitting in this magnetic field, her first time in the office, and she's just sitting there in the magnetic field and the generator's just running, humming along. And I'm in the other room doing a production trial layout because we're actually trying to mass produce these items. She's in there for about 20 minutes, and then we hear her crying. And we thought, oh my gosh, you know, she's fallen, she's hurt herself or something. And we went in there, and her hand had stopped moving. And we said, you know, wow, what's wrong? And she said, nothing. My hand has quit tremoring for the first time in 8 years. So now that effect was temporary, but she came back over and over again. And about 6 weeks later, she came in with her physiotherapist, and we thought, oh my gosh, we are in so much trouble. But she said, no, I want to know what you're doing here, because this woman is now back in physical therapy, and she's back in the pool doing a strength training, which she's long since given up because of the tremors. Whatever you're doing here has as much effect as the best drugs we have, and we want to know what you're doing. Now, that made me a believer. Something is really going on here.
Absolutely. And it's, again, recognizing that there are things called fields, and medicine doesn't recognize it. And why that's a problem is medicine will scientifically recognize something if it conforms to their belief system. But if it doesn't conform to the belief system, then they can't see how something works, so they say, well, you know, there's no science for this. Well, that's because there's no science the way they look at it. But the unfortunate part about it is allopathic medicine is still a Newtonian-based science that says there's a physical universe, focus on that, and that's all you need to know. Yet it lives in a quantum universe that we now understand is an energy-based universe, and they still are myopically ignoring the role of the energy and trying to just look at everything as being a physical consequence, and this is why they can't open their eyes to these things, and unfortunately why even when they're pushing these physical remedies, that they're causing greater damage in many cases than they are improving health. But it's a one-horse show. All they do is know how to make drugs and sell drugs. But if it's not drugs, it doesn't work in their belief system.
Well, we have been talking about altering the environment in which the cells exist, whether it's by thought or by energy. We've established that there are small proteins on the cell membrane that act like little antennas, and they pick up signals. And we don't really know, or at least not enough study has been done, as to what exactly those signals are. What frequency is it? Is it light? Is it sound? Is it radio? There are all kinds of experiments being done right now, but unfortunately, from an industry point of view, there's no support. So this is going to have to be done, you know, with programs like this and with books like Bruce's. So, you know, I have to admit that when I saw your description of the cell membrane as a liquid crystal, I couldn't help but compare the image to these little antennae ready to receive signals. They pick up complementary signals, but is it possible that they could pick up signals from the thoughts of the person and maybe even from the thoughts or intention of others around them?
Yeah. Well, this is really where I think it's all going to come down to, is that one of the reasons why the cells have these antennas is that sort of it's like an internet system, that all information is now on this broadcast band, so that all 50 trillion cells can be in tune with a central voice and with each other at one point. So it's a giant connected matrix of cells rather than a bunch of cells doing this and a bunch of cells doing that.
Right.
And
right.
So they're tuned to so that all cells can be watching what's going on in their world. So whatever the eyes see essentially is interpreted to some degree, so cells know whether it's a good place or a scary place or what's going on. And they're getting these broadcasts. Well, the interesting part about that is then we could also get entangled, and this happens when two people's fields come together. They can actually be entangled and then share information across the field in a nonverbal communication. There are wonderful experiments, for example, in putting two people into like Faraday cages separated from each other. These are supposedly electromagnetically shielded cages. And what they do is they have both people first meditate on the presence of the other one being there. So they're in a meditative state like the other one is right there with them. But they're now separated by 50 feet. And what they do is they flash a light into one of the participants' eyes at a certain strobing rate that causes the brain to fire very rapidly in what's called an evoked potential. So they're stimulating an evoked potential in one of the people by flashing a light in their eyes. What's interesting is that at the moment the one has the evoked potential, the other one 50 feet away also has an evoked potential at exactly the same time. And the significance is that there's this communication over distances between two people. Now, people on an anecdotal level are very familiar with this, where you want to call somebody and you're at the moment you're calling them, they're calling you. Or these long distance communications where a parent knows that something's wrong with a child, even though that child may be halfway around the world. We know these exist, but again, they don't fit into our conventional medical awareness, so these things are dismissed as just anecdotal evidence. But the unfortunate part for medicine is anytime they test the drug, it's also anecdotal evidence. Did it work or it didn't work? And what was the rating of that person? It's just based on the belief system. So the same reason they reject other people's data, it doesn't fit their science. It's not really scientifically valid to do that. So we're beginning to find that the communications between people can lead to a lot of, like aboriginals actually communicate without actually a lot of verbal communication. It's from mind to mind. And as a result, by an entanglement, then one person can influence the health of another person. And this is really where a healer with a strong sense of harmony and balance in a strong field can entrain a person who is not well, whose energy is off, who's in a state of disharmony, can entrain them because of the power and the harmony in their own system, so that when two people come together, the more powerful one can influence the other. This happens, for example, in girls' dorms, where when they come in at the beginning of the year, the girls generally may have all different schedules for their menstrual cycles. But after living in the dorm for a period of time, they entrained with one another and with especially entrained to the more powerful field, the ones with the more powerful field, so that at some point they all start to end up having a coherence of their menstrual cycles one with the other because of the influence of other people in the field. So, yes, this happens all the time. It's the nature of communication between people. We ignore the invisible communication. In fact, in our developmental programming, are generally encouraged not even to go there. If people say, oh, I have these strange thoughts and feelings, or I could read these feelings and things like that, as children, they're sort of like, you know, do that in the closet, don't tell people.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we're programmed out of that.
And we get programmed out of a higher level of communication that we were endowed with and left to only respond to a verbal communication. And that itself creates a problem because people can lie with words, but you can't really lie with vibrations.
Well, this entanglement now, we talked about how difficult, if not impossible, it was for the conscious mind to speak to the unconscious mind, like talking to a voice recorder that's spewing out something that's been recorded on it, or having a conversation with somebody's voicemail. It's just not going to go anywhere.
It's not going anywhere.
However, this entanglement now, we're talking about unconscious communicating with unconscious at a very rapid baud rate, are we not?
Yeah, but it's also open really through a conscious level as well, a conscious level on the intent part of the healer, for example. There's an intention to heal. That's a conscious level, which is, remember, we said the conscious is very powerful but can't control too many things at once. So a healer that puts all of their intention and focus onto the healing thing is very powerful with like a laser with that consciousness for healing because of that, of the power. So when two people come together, there's an entrainment that goes to the more powerful individual. So a person out of harmony can get into harmony by being in the right field, but it still requires intentions on the part of those people to make that happen.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I know when we talk about intention and we talk about attention, and we do that from time to time on this program as well, most people think that the brain is where the mind exists. In your book, you talk about Candace Pert's experiments. What did her results reveal about the location of the human mind?
Well, in her particular experiments, what she was trying to show is that every cell is responding to the field of information that's being distributed throughout the body all at once, and that portions of the body are sending information to other portions of the body, so that the gut is sending information back to the central nervous system as well as receiving information from that central nervous system. So it's an integrated network of a whole, and you can't take any one part out and say it's something separate unto itself. It's all
right.
One giant interacting whole. But then there's another part to this, and the issue is Candace's work is still on the physical level. That's why the book is called Molecules of Emotion, because she's still talking about physical molecules activating these switches. But now we know, no, you don't need the physical molecules, just the field will activate the switches. And there's a lot of quantum biophysics now in identifying, you mentioned earlier, the frequencies haven't been clearly defined, but they are now beginning to identify quantum field effects that cause the proteins to shift in their structure. And here's an interesting experiment, and you might be familiar with, maybe talked about it before in your show, by a scientist by the name of Cleve Baxter. Are you familiar with his work, Cleve Baxter?
No,
I think
not.
He wrote The Secret Life of Plants.
Wait a second. I'm going to send this out on the airwaves. Someone either in the studio or somewhere has a phone off the hook, because I'm picking up another conversation in the background.
Yeah, me too.
There's a little bit of a time delay for this to get to the studio, so by the time they get this, maybe they can fix it. But I'm hearing something going on in the background. We apologize to the listeners. We'll try to work over it, unless we have a caller on the line that I'm not aware about. Do we have a caller on the line? No. Okay, so we'll just wait.
It's quiet now, though.
Okay, so we have sufficiently...
We did, Dr. Agnew, we did have a caller on the line. But he's just been on the line forever waiting. I thought you heard me a couple times. I guess I didn't get loud enough.
Well, let's try that.
I missed it. So next caller, we'll make sure to put you on the air. I apologize if I missed him, but we didn't hear the announcement, so I apologize. So let's talk about Clive's work. How did that go?
Well, what he was working with fields and influencing on how cells are affected by these fields. And what he showed was that he could take cells from a person's body, put them in a petri dish, and then moved those cells about 2 miles, and he said up to 40 miles away in a completely different laboratory. And he would have the readout. He was a researcher and pioneer in lie detectors and galvanic responses and electric fields. And when lie detectors sort of went out of use, he started looking at organisms with this more sensitive devices and found that he could read fields of cells. Well, what was interesting was he did experiments where an individual was at least 2 to 40 miles away from their cells. And he had a recording, a lifetime recording, coming from the lab where the cells were. And he had a video recording of the individual that he was interviewing. And he had a split screen, so he had the electrical recording of the cells on one side and the image of the person from which the cells were derived on the other side of the screen. And what he showed is that when the person had an emotional response, instantaneously, 2 or 40 miles away, his own cells changed their electrical activity in exact response to the emotion.
Really?
And why that's relevant is because it reveals that what might be in the mind of this individual is not localized, because the cells are responding to it, you know, to or up to 40 miles away. Cells are responding to this person's emotion and mindset, and they're separated by that great distance, and they respond instantaneously. So it really refers to the non-local character of part of us. There's an identity, a spirit, a broadcast, or whatever it is, that is not localized, so that at least it's more than 40 miles, because a person cells 40 miles away can still respond to them. And well, that shows us that there are parts of this mind or this field of identity that is not localized at all and influential over distances. So this really opens up a Pandora's box, at least in regard to what conventional medicine has wanted to look at. There is a non-local environmental influence, and we have to start looking at that.
I would submit that this happens almost on a subspace level. You said instantaneously. It was probably much faster than the speed of light. And I would submit that this entanglement is on an energy level, an energy entanglement, maybe past the ions of the cells that make up the protein, or the proteins that make up the cells of this being. And if that's the case, and it probably could clinically prove it, or at least scientifically prove it, my expertise is in instrumental physics, not astrophysics or quantum physics, but I would say that this entanglement goes on an energy level, and it goes much, much deeper than just a man and his cells. Maybe it is the human being and the planet, or the human being and the universe.
I fully support that. That's why I think it's relevant for us as a group to own who we really are after centuries of programming our subconscious with limitations and self-sabotaging beliefs, which keep us from expressing our true powers. And the fact is, we are creating the world as we're living it through quantum physics. This is what quantum physicists have revealed, that the observer is the creator of the reality. And we haven't wanted to own it because it seems so alien to our focus on the conventional material mechanical world. To introduce this into a population, it's just like, it's mind-boggling. And physicists have left it out of their own discussion, even though this is exactly the conclusion that was presented by the principal physicists, including Planck, back in the 1920s.
Sure.
They said,
sure,
this is a mental creation. And yet, even physicists couldn't bring it into their own day-to-day, 9-to-5 lives. So it's been a discussion that's always been left out, except quantum physicists are trying to awaken us to this fact right now, that this is an immaterial mental universe, and that that distance and time or things that we've put into it are not necessarily the structure of where we actually are in the universe.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was immaterial or imaginary. I mean, there is a dichotomy.
No. Immaterial, I don't want to say imaginary. It's conscious. it's
yeah.
a shaping. David Bohm would talk about the implicit and the explicit order that we're taking out of randomness and shaping matter and order from with consciousness.
Sure.
And that gives us responsibility.
There are people that are not conscious that they're conscious. I mean, there are two different kinds of people. There are the people that are acted upon by the universe, and then there are people that are acting upon the universe.
But those people that are acted upon have been programmed, and so they're unconsciously generating the whatever program they've been put in. They're manifesting it through their playback devices of the program. So unconsciously, they're contributing to the belief of whoever programmed them. So
that
the population is moldable.
Let's talk about a real profound example of that programming. You mentioned the famous Lond case where he was being treated for esophageal cancer. Tell us that story. This is a really good example of bad programming.
Which one? From the esophageal cancer story was this Dr. Medawar who realized that he had diagnosed his patient with esophageal cancer. He also, at the time, it was a conventional medical belief that if you had esophageal cancer, your chances of survival are very slim. So essentially, he told this guy, well, basically, you're going to die from this esophageal cancer, and there's really no way out of it. So the patient did die, and everybody around was like, well, yeah, you know, he had esophageal cancer. Of course he died of the cancer. But when they did the autopsy, there was no esophageal cancer. He had a couple of such minor nodes of cancer that in no way would they have caused him to die. And so the question was, well, why did he die? And the answer is, at least the doctor comes down to, is that he believed he was going to die. I told him he was going to die. His family believed he was going to die. He believed he was going to die. He died, but he died with the idea of cancer, but he didn't die from cancer. So,
how did that make Medawar feel?
Well, he says I've been kicking myself for years, about contributing to this person's death, and it's interesting because we talked earlier about the placebo effect, and most everybody out there in the audience has heard the placebo effect about it. It's like, okay, I have positive thoughts that this pill is going to heal me, and even if it's a sugar pill, it heals me because I believe the pill. And this is a positive consequence of positive thoughts. What people don't generally hear out there in the world is the opposite but equal effect of the placebo effect. It's called the nocebo effect. The nocebo effect is when a person has a negative belief and it results in a negative consequence such as disease or death. And the point is that positive or negative, it's the belief that caused the result. So they're equally powerful, positive and negative beliefs. We never talk about the power of the negative beliefs because we always focus on the power of the placebo effect. But this case of this esophageal cancer and many other kinds of cases attest to the fact that if a person has a negative belief about an outcome, it can change their biology, cause a disease, and can even cause death. Because it's equally powerful as the placebo, but in the opposite direction. And
now we really are talking about the biology of belief. You know, the difference between an optimist and a pessimist. The optimist believes we live in the best of all possible worlds, and the pessimist fears that's true.
What happened to
the health of the person who sees and chooses to live in a world full of love compared to one who chooses to live in a world full of fear and darkness? What's the difference?
And there's a simple reason even. It's so simple, the difference between them, and it's something I saw and I learned from myself in tissue culture. And it basically said this: if I put nutrients in front of my cells in the tissue culture dish and put it back in the incubator and come back in a short time, all the cells are gathered around the nutrients. If in a parallel petri plate I put toxins in front of the cells and put them in the incubator and come back the same time as I did for the other plate, in the plate with toxins, the cells are on the opposite side of the dish. And what I saw was the first insight that the cells offered me is that cells cannot be in growth and in protection at the same time.
Right.
They're physiologically, it's like the problem of being a particle and a wave. They're mutually exclusive. Meaning this, for growth means you have to be open to take things in. That's what growth is all about. You take things in. But protection is to close yourself off to prevent things from coming in. So the issue is you can't be open and closed at the same time. So therefore, cells are either in growth or cells are in protection. Now here's the problem. Remember we talked about cells like people. So imagine a community back in the 1950s when we thought the Russians were going to come and bomb us. We built bomb shelters. And I would say, okay, it's a beautiful day. The community is alive and awake and working. The schools are open. The factories are open. The stores are open. Business is going. The community is growing. It's a healthy, harmonious state of growth. And then all of a sudden I say, there's an air raid alarm. Well, the moment they hear the alarm, everybody stops their job and runs into the bomb shelter. So I say, well, at the moment they're all in the bomb shelter, is the system growing? No, they're in protection. The machine, everything's shut down. You're not growing when you're in protection. And then I say, well, if it was just an air raid test and 10 minutes later they come out of the bomb shelter, not a big problem. It's just a short, like a large coffee break. Then everything's back on track again. But here's the problem. If the air raid siren goes off and all the people go into the bomb shelter, growth stops. That's true. But the question is this, how long can you maintain your survival in the bomb shelter?
Right.
The answer is, well, for as long as you've got reserves, and then the moment you run out of reserves, you die. Well, here's the problem. When the brain, the central voice, interprets the environment as being fearful or stressful or threatening, it sends information to the cells like air raid alert. All the cells then get into a protection posture to conserve energy, to get ready for fight or flight, and to shut down unnecessary functions and process, to reduce the immune system's function, and to shut it all down. Why? Because if you're going to need to run, you're going to need all the energy you have available. So what you have to do is shut down everything that's not relevant for protection. Point? The moment you get in fear, you shut off the growth of the system and get it in a get-set mode for a response. Well, the problem is the world we live in today is chronic fear, chronic protection. That's equivalent to having your cells go into the bomb shelter and not come out again. That means the more fear we're under, the less health we have because the more we're shutting off growth. And all you have to do is look at the health statistics of the United States and recognize that right after 2-1-1, the health of the United States almost stopped and died. That the president, after a few days of scaring everybody, realized, my God, what happened when he scared everybody? All the businesses closed. All the growth stopped. The country was, as a group, all in the bomb shelter. And the reality was that the biological humor of what he said. He was on one hand saying, okay, be very afraid of these terrorists. And on the other hand, he was saying, America's open for business.
Yeah.
And the reason was because he scared them into protection, which shut off growth. And then he tried to talk them out of the protection by telling them to go spend money. Well, that's what people are doing, but the same thing happens inside the body to your cells. They're the community that is responding to your air raid warnings and your sirens and your alarms and all that. The cells are in this state of protection. And the more protection we got into, the sicker Americans became. And in fact, the pharmaceutical companies reported 20% per year increase for 5 years in a row after 9-1-1. They're making 100% more profit after 5 years because we're so much in fear that our illnesses and our sicknesses are so great now that they're making money hand over fist because we're living in protection.
Well, what we want to do is unlearn those bad habits and fears.
Absolutely.
A nice quote in your book, and it's a good way to end a fabulous 3 hours with you. You said, a lifetime without love is of no account. Love is the water of life. Drink it down with heart and soul.
That's a roomy.
That's really
great. That's a wonderful quote, and that's what we have to learn because in this world, we're so afraid, and we've lost the nature of the community. The family is gone, that unit's gone, the community is gone, and the problem with that is a body that loses community is a body that expresses cancer. When cells start to say, well, I'm not involved with, I don't care what the whole community's doing, I'm doing this for myself. And now we start to realize, well, this thing's falling apart because we haven't realized our oneness as one living nation is like a body, and we are the cells in this body, and there's so much disharmony in this body that it's expressing disease the same way any cellular body that has disharmony in it also expresses disease. So there's a lot of lessons to be acquired from understanding what happens in our cellular communities inside our body and what's happening in our people community that we're living in and outside of our body. There are the same things that are going on.
Wow. Many lessons to be learned in this interview and in this great book, The Biology of Belief. Bruce, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the program here. I have to say we're lifted by your presence on the program tonight. And it's a pleasure to add your book and your words tonight to my cellular programming. So may love and health go with you all, and I appreciate you. So have a great rest of the week, my friend.
Brooke, thank you so much for this opportunity. I hope some people can feel that there's a lot of light and a lot of hope, and it's looking like it's dark, but that's just the symptoms of an evolution for something far greater coming our way.
Exactly. We're on the verge of it as a race. All right. Thank you, my friend, and good night.
Thank you again.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.